Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two guests today. In moments, Sam Gindin will talk about the UAW's strike against GM and what could be done with a plant the company is abandoning in Ontario. And then in the follow-up to last week's interview with John Clegg on how slavery shaped the U.S. political economy, Robin Einhorn will discuss that wretched institution's influence on taxation in the U.S. from colonial times through the Civil War. First, autos. On Monday, some 46,000 members of the United Auto Workers Union went on strike against GM to try to recoup some of the concessions they made as part of the financial crisis bailout of the company a decade ago, and to get a piece of the $35 billion in profits GM has made over the last 3 years. Those concessions included an increase in the number of workers, mostly younger, who are paid considerably less than the veterans, and GM wants workers to pay more for their health insurance. Also, GM has been closing plants in the U.S. and Canada as it relocates more production to Mexico, and a group of workers and activists in Ontario have some ideas about what to do with one of the plants the company is abandoning. Here's Sam Gindin, who is the research director for the Canadian Auto Workers Union from 1974 to 2000, to talk about both. Sam, who's been on Behind the News many times before, is also the co-author, with his good friend and frequent collaborator Leo Panitch, of The Making of Global Capitalism, published by Verso in 2012. Sam Gindin. Before we talk about what could be done, what do you make of the UAW strike against GM? What are the issues and what are the prospects?
Well, it's complicated, of course, by the corruption charges at the top. And that gets complicated because it raises the question of the credibility of the leadership. So on the one hand, it actually means that there's more of a chance of a rebellion from below, because the leadership could usually smother those things through its control of the bargaining process. And right now, there's the possibility of rebellion from below around issues like the two-tier system and also higher wages because of how they've basically been screwed for the last decade, making these commitments to GM and then never really getting the job security.
This two-tier system dates to the time of the financial crisis bailout?
Yeah, it goes back to 2007 in the U.S. It's more recent in Canada. But the thing I wanted to say about that is that there's two questions here. One is how the strike will turn out and how any rebellion from the members might be sustained, which is incredibly difficult. You suddenly are thrown out there and you don't have the structures if the union's not behind you. But it raises another question, which is after the strike is over, if the fight is significant, that this might be a moment of a new leadership emerging through the course of the strike and then after the strike because of the crisis at the top in the UAW.
For people who don't understand the corruption scandal, what's that all about?
Well, again, all of these things go deeper than it looks. It really starts with the union and the company setting up training programs for workers to improve their skills, which sounds innocent enough. But it was part of moving towards cooperation between the company and the union rather than the union seeing itself as an independent body representing its members. And what it gave to the union leadership was a whole clientelist system of people that they could give jobs to, people who could come to otherwise poorly attended meetings and make decisions that were consistent with the leadership. And over time, it just became more corrupted because the companies used the funds to give benefits, personal benefits, to the leadership, $300 pens, you know, expensive trips to go golfing, incredible meals with liquor. So it's become corruption in that crude sense, but there was always based on this corruption of what the union was supposed to be representing and fighting for its members, and the illusion that if you cooperated with the company, this would get you anything.
And so the current strike, what prompted it and what are the issues?
There's a couple of things behind it. One is that the unions made concessions in 2007 and after that as well when GM was in trouble. And they thought that that was, or it was sold to them and accepted as investments in their own future. If they could save GM, this would help them in the future when GM was restored to profitability. And what in fact happened is, of course, GM bases its operations on its profitability. So there wasn't job security for the workers in the long term. And they made all those concessions for no good reason. And now that GM is really profitable, they want a lot of that back. So there's that issue. And at the same time, they want to see whether they can actually get some job security for the future. So those are really the two main issues, with the addition that one of the concessions wasn't just a normal concession. It was, you know, where workers collectively give up something. It was concessions that were biased to make younger workers carry the load. And that's very important because it means people doing exactly the same job can get wages that are, you know, different by 80% or so. And that divides the union. And in terms of thinking about the renewal of the union, if this is what you're doing to younger workers, making the union part of them being second-class citizens, it's not a very healthy basis for reviving the union. So that's a critical part of it.
An injury to one is not an injury to all, apparently, under that philosophy.
No, and it's one thing when you collectively say, look, we don't have the power to win something today. We may have to make concessions. You know, you can raise questions about that, but that's one thing. But when you start saying some workers are going to be put in the position of making concessions in order to save the jobs for the others, which ends up, of course, meaning that the whole union is weak, and then the others eventually pay for this too, you're really destroying the whole purpose of the union.
Concessions have been standard practice for the UAW for, what, 3 or 4 decades, it seems. They've gotten nothing from it, really. Why do they persist in agreeing to them?
Well, first of all, just to get, you know, your original comments in context, at the end of the 70s, when the concession period started, there were over 400,000 members at GM, probably closer to 450,000, and it's 46,000 today. And every set of negotiations since then was based on the principle of if you give up something, that'll give you job security. So the bankruptcy, you know, at that, in those earlier days, you might have believed it reluctantly, but you might have said, okay. You know, so it's one thing to have believed it when you, back then, but having had that experience, there's no reason to believe it at all. So the question is, why does this happen? And it reflects on the bankruptcy of the union. The fact that things have changed dramatically in society in terms of corporate power, and the unions haven't changed with it in terms of thinking that the way they used to get gains in the 50s and 60s when the economy was doing well, that era is over, and the union has never adjusted to it. So what you end up with is in every set of bargaining, people look at what their options are, and they say, gee, we don't have many options. And even if we've lost all these jobs, maybe we can save what's left. And unless you're ready to challenge the corporations fundamentally in terms of their control over investment, their undemocratic control over people's lives in the community, if you're not ready to do that, then over time you just keep getting weakened and your options are narrow when you make these kinds of decisions. I should say back in the 60s, this was becoming an issue because then there was militancy in the 60s and into the 70s against the beginnings of concessions. But workers never went beyond that militancy. And if you don't go beyond that militancy and see this as a political problem, a problem for control over investment, eventually through higher unemployment, through the threats of moving, you get weakened. And that's what happened. And that's a key lesson from the 70s is that even militancy isn't enough. You have to go beyond that.
A standard right-wing critique of unions is that there were ways of protecting insiders from competition from the outside. And you look at these concessions and these two-tier arrangements, and you think the right wing might have a point, that people who are the beneficiaries of a union are quite willing to have other people become bear the burdens of adjustment, and that the unions or the members are not capable of looking beyond their own narrow inner circle towards a larger general interest. I mean, is that part of the problem?
Yes, you know, in the sense that, you know, in the 50s and 60s, you could take care of your members and you'd end up setting standards that raise standards for everybody else. And you could say that you were actually acting in a way that supported the class. Right now, and part of it is because of neoliberalism and workers, you know, being forced to be defensive and just look after themselves, even without a two-tier system. Unions aren't class organizations. They're organizations that represent a particular group of workers, even if they're democratic. They're elected to represent a particular group of workers. And what are the changes that has to happen to respond to that? I mean, there are all kinds of ways of responding to the right in terms of saying, look, we're improving the benefits and we know what the right would do. And that's all true. Unions do play a role in this. But to really respond to that, you have to think in terms of the class because we can't win unless we see this in terms of class struggles and ask, well, what does that actually mean about how we behave, what we put our resources into, how we relate to the community, how we relate to other workers? And so absolutely, the failure to act in class terms is now one of the reasons for the downfalls of unions.
I'm speaking with Sam Gindin, who spent many years with the Canadian Auto Workers Union.
Switching to the possibility of going beyond the traditional model of unions, there's a plant in Ontario that's going to be closed, and you and others are suggesting that it should be purchased to make a different kind of vehicle. So, first of all, what's the story of the plant?
Well, the story of the plant is it's in Oshawa. It was the largest auto complex in North America through the 80s, 90s, and it's won every award for quality and everything else. And it was one of the plants that GM closed, along with the plants that closed in the United States. And like in the United States, in the last round of bargaining, the company asked for concessions, and the union gave them with the promise of job security. And, of course, after that was done, the company just said there's nothing allocated there. So what was raised by a group of workers in Oshawa that we've been working with is that at some point you have to start thinking beyond the company. There's no solution in General Motors. The union tried to shame GM into reversing its decision, and after a really expensive campaign that didn't involve the members at all, it hired a PR company, GM then promised 300 jobs to end that campaign, and who knows whether that'll be delivered. So the obvious question is, well, this is a dead-end street. Giving handouts to the companies, giving them concessions, giving them tax breaks, it doesn't work. I mean, this is the concrete lesson. And so can we start thinking beyond the companies themselves? And to do that, you also have to link up with society as a whole. And the obvious way to do that is to link this to the environment. So what we proposed was that the government actually take over this facility, which has all kinds of equipment, paint shops, assembly line, tool and die shop, body shop, and the skills of the workers and the skills that exist in the community. And why don't we convert it to something that is socially useful, that isn't based on profitability and competition? In this case, the obvious one is the environment, electric vehicles that can be purchased for the post office or for hydro or for other government procurement are an obvious example, but it can go beyond that. It can think about making things for an aging population, electrified motor vehicles.
Wheelchairs.
And get creative about what you can think about. You can think about maybe the future of transportation has to involve zip cars, which are run by the municipality as a way of car sharing. Maybe we have to look at more smaller shuttle buses that give the transportation system flexibility. Maybe we have to look at school buses. So the point is to start thinking creatively about what we can do with our skills and to think outside what's profitable, think in terms of social use, link this to the environment, build a movement around that. And it's a struggle. This is very difficult, politically and technically.
A technical detail here. Without a move like this, GM would just move the equipment to Mexico? Is that what would happen?
It would move it someplace. Yeah, it would move it someplace because a lot of that equipment is useful. Sometimes it's shipped to the third world, and sometimes it'll just be sold for whatever they can get for it. But the point is, without this, you have a massive plant that might have 300 jobs in it, some corner of it. And it's hard to imagine that kind of a plant surviving anyways. And the land would go to land developers, presumably, to build condos. And, the point is that having a productive capacity is so important, because one of the things about the environment is if you're really going to change everything about infrastructure, about how you work, how you live, how you travel, you're going to have a capacity to do this.
Yeah, when people talk about the Green New Deal here, it's sometimes just treated like a financial decision. But we need different kinds of industrial infrastructure to make something like that happen, right? I mean, and that's going to take some work.
Absolutely. There's two parts of that. One is what you just said, which is critical. And the other is actually engaging in workers. Because when you say to workers, there'll be a just transition, well, that's an abstract slogan to them, because they see it as, well, you don't have the power to guarantee me that. To do that, you actually need some form of democratic planning. And to have democratic planning, you have to have some control over property rights and corporations. So when workers hear that, even if they're sympathetic, they hear it as an abstract slogan. Whereas if you're engaged in a struggle with workers, if the environmental movement was part of the struggle that talked about conversion, and conversion inherently needs some kind of planning, and the environment needs some kind of a planning, then you're starting to build a real political base. And without that, it's very abstract.
Developing on this, how would the plant be taken over? Would you need government assistance to do something like that, or could it be done by the workers alone?
No, you don't absolutely need government assistance for all kinds of things. I mean, if this was a small operation, you could imagine a co-op or something. But this needs major investments. This means getting access to all kinds of technical skills that companies have monopolized. I mean, workers can do their jobs, and they can be very creative in it, but their experience under capitalism does not give them the skills to run these kinds of operations on their own without a lot of support from research and development and engineering. So it would be a major, major investment. The other thing about this is that it should go with establishing transportation environment hub at the plant. You know, a few hundred young engineers who are actually looking at what could be done and how do you do it. So it's a larger operation than just saying, let the workers just occupy the plant and run it. It becomes a political thing where these great skills that workers do have that are very important, and they can do all kinds of things, and they can do a lot more than they think they can do. But you would need resources, financial and technical, to really pull this off. And then, critically, you need a market. Because you don't want to just say, okay, now we're going to compete with China and Mexico and the U.S. And so what we're talking about is the basis for a market has to come through government procurement, and the government has to accelerate its environmental standards so that everybody really does have to convert to electric. And that gives you the basis for a market. And once you're doing that, you can find other things to do to supplement this.
Years ago, Christian Parenti wrote a piece for The Nation in which he quoted the proprietor of a small, I believe it's a transmission plant, that built transmissions for electric vehicles. And he said just the runs weren't large enough to make it economical for him to stay in business. But he said, you know, if the post office bought electric vehicles, then UPS and FedEx would buy electric vehicles. But that government procurement could begin to create a market that would produce the size and scale necessary to make this economically feasible. Is this the kind of thing you're thinking about?
Yeah, we have a feasibility study coming out tomorrow. It's a preliminary study. To do a really detailed one would cost a fortune. But that's the kind of direction that it's looking at. It's trying to see what are the potentials from government procurement, because you do need some economies of scale, although the economies of scale get exaggerated. So, for example, transmissions have major economies of scale, but we'd likely be, you know, we'd be buying the transmissions. So it is a question of how much you can do through government procurement as a foundation. Even if government procurement isn't big enough, it's important as a foundation. And then if you're not trying to maximize profits, instead of running a plant at 240,000, you know, you can run it at 50 to 100,000 and you might be a little bit less efficient, but the social costs and benefits still make it possible. So that's crucial. But part of the market is political. It really does depend on what is the government going to do to force the real conversion to electric vehicles so that the market for that expands.
Is there any likelihood of interest coming from the Ontario provincial or the federal government?
Well, we've got from the Ontario provincial government, zero. You know, at best you can put them on the spot so they're not attacking it and, you know, maybe support a study or something. And there's an election going on, and the Liberals are vulnerable because in the last election they ran very much on the environment and then ended up pouring tons of money into pipelines. So there's a question of whether we can use the election to get it on the agenda. I would say two things about it that I think are important. One is that the long term is always made up of short term, you know, series of short terms. And for the long term, raising something like this is part of trying to get people to think beyond what exists, to think bigger. And having a project like this, which now is getting some media attention and getting it out there, is part of making people begin to think so that they do think in terms of possibilities. Next time something closes in their community, maybe they'll join us too. So there's this longer term attempt to change how we think about things, because the most important thing about the defeat of the working class is the lowering of expectations on what's possible. But on the other hand, workers live in the short term. So they're always asking, is this possible? Do I want to commit to doing something like this? And the point about closures is that suddenly you don't have any other options. So it's worth looking at. But to be honest about it, it's going to be very difficult to create, you know, the political context in which this can happen. We just have to try to do it. And you just can't do those kinds of things overnight. You can't be sitting around watching your community and your life collapse and then wake up one day and think that, hey, I got a great idea and that'll change it. So it is part of a longer struggle, and we just have to push and see how far we can take this now.
Here in the U.S., the Green New Deal and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez certainly not become dominant in politics, but they have shifted the discourse. Is anything comparable happening up north?
Yeah, I think this is one of the examples where you're influencing us.
Really?
The environmental movement. I think that the environmental movement deserves enormous credit for getting it on the agenda. The problem is that it's becoming kind of motherhood. Almost everybody will say they support the Green New Deal. And on the one hand, there's the financial questions that you raised earlier, which I think we have to take more seriously. You can't just say it'll pay for itself. You actually have to recognize this is a radical change in social priorities and social power. So that's one issue. And the other issue is to really get people engaged, because you can't do this unless you really challenge corporate power. So yes, it's on the agenda, and it's, the polls all show support for a Green New Deal and even talk about conversion. But then you have to get down to the nitty gritty and what kind of a commitment people are really ready to make to this challenging power and changing their own lives in a lot of ways. And that's the real issue, I think.
There's a lot of talk among supporters of the Green New Deal about this, it will pay for itself. And that makes me really suspicious. I don't think it really will pay for itself, at least in the short to medium term. We have to be honest that these are really wrenching changes we're calling for.
Absolutely. I mean, it'd be hard to, we don't have time to get into a whole discussion of modern monetary theory and fiscal Keynesianism in this case, but we really, if we don't recognize that what we're talking about is a radical transformation of society, not just some plants, but of society, and that includes values, and especially it includes power, there's no easy way of doing that, which is different than saying it's impossible. It is impossible, but it's only possible if we recognize what we're going to be up against and prepare for that.
Yeah, I was arguing with Bob Poland about this. You think Bob Poland thinks it's all going to pay for itself. I said, no, Bob, it's not going to pay for itself.
Yeah, I think Ann Pettifor just did an article in The Guardian saying the same, laying out that argument. And it's not just that it's not right. It means that we don't prepare people. We tell them that we've got a solution for you that's easy. And when it turns out not to be so easy, we lose people. We just have to recognize that. You're really challenging capitalism here.
That was Sam Gindin, who spent many years as research director of the Canadian Auto Workers Union. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the Sonata Kirkpatrick No. 273 by Domenico Scarlatti from the complete run of those sonatas by Scott Ross, which you can find on YouTube. Next, slavery in American history, specifically taxation. Last week, I interviewed John Clegg on how slavery shaped a good deal of the political economy of the U.S. in ways that aren't often fully appreciated. I'm assuming that the creation of a subordinate, hyper-exploited population and a whole set of racist structures, practices, and consciousness is more fully appreciated, but maybe I'm being generous. Clegg mentioned a book by Robin Einhorn, American Taxation, American Slavery, as an important work on the topic. The book covers the political fights over taxation in the U.S. from colonial times through the Civil War. The resistance of slaveholders to being taxed shaped both the Constitution and our whole subsequent political culture. Here's Robin Einhorn, a professor emerita of history at Berkeley. Slavery was an enormous issue in American history, and you wrote a book about how it shaped our early tax structure. Let's talk first about the pre-revolutionary tax structure of the colonies. Extraordinarily primitive, especially in the South, right?
Right. I mean, much more primitive in the South than in the North. You had basically modern property taxation in New England, assessors annually assessing the value of a lot of different forms of property and then levying a rate and local rates for local government, counties, schools, and so on. No southern colony, I was so shocked to learn this, before the revolution assessed the value of property. It was stunning. And my best explanation for why that was is the planters couldn't deal with having, assessors, officials come and intrude on their property. And what are they going to do? They're going to assess the value of the people, right, of the enslaved people. And what are they going to do? They're going to ask them questions. One of my favorite southern taxes, this was very early South Carolina. They had an import tax on slaves, which was a great way to finance South Carolina because they were importing tons and tons of enslaved people. And what was normally done in ways of valuing slaves was they used age and sex categories usually. But in this case, they valued them by height. And I thought this was just so bizarre, right? Until you realize that if you value people by their height, you don't have to ask them any questions. How old are you? How do you feel, right? Are you ill? Do you seem likely to run away? All the things that a slave might lie about, but might also have the answers to questions that could help in evaluation procedure with height, they don't have to talk at all. So I thought that was kind of an amazing tax.
But then as the U.S. was stumbling towards nationhood, it was very difficult for the national government or even the collective pre-national government to raise any kind of revenue on its own, right? It had this patchwork of state tax systems, some of them sophisticated, some of them rather very crude. And when under the Articles of Confederation or even moving towards the Constitutional Convention, taxing to raise money for the collective central government was nearly impossible. What were the disputes? Why was it so difficult to come to any kind of strategy towards raising revenue for the infant nation?
Right. So when they were first framing the Articles of the Confederation, we're talking now 3 weeks after the adoption of the Declaration of Independence, they're trying to decide how they can have a government that can mobilize the states for the war against Britain. And they know they need money. War requires money. So they know they need money. And so they want to have a tax system. And they're like, okay, let's tax the relative wealth of the states, which is kind of already crazy because no southern state had ever done it. But okay, let's do it by wealth. So how do we measure wealth? And the obvious thing that they had some prayer of being able to accomplish was according to population. Well, the minute you're going to talk about counting the population, you have to talk about counting the population of enslaved African Americans. So once they start talking about counting enslaved people and the Southerners start talking about how they're worthless, they don't like to work, they're lazy, they're inefficient, they're incompetent, therefore they should not be taxed as much as white people, free people. And the Northerners are like, are you out of your mind? You make money from slavery. So this conversation starts happening, and Southerners go bananas, and this one guy from South Carolina threatens to secede from the Union. This is 3 weeks after the Declaration of Independence. If there's a conversation about whether our slaves are our property, we're out of here. It was just impossible. And then several other times, whenever they tried to get serious about taxes, they tried to have this conversation again. And it's in the course of a kind of a reprise of this, a very important reprise of this in 1783, that they come up with a three-fifths ratio that then enters the Constitution.
Which was both about representation and taxation.
Representatives and direct taxes shall be distributed to the states by a count of the population that includes the white people and doesn't include Indians not taxed, a phrase that meant Indians not yet conquered by Euro-Americans. The states were not taxing them. So you don't count the natives, you do count all of the whites, and then you count three-fifths of what the Constitution called all other persons, understood to mean enslaved Africans, African-Americans. And the purpose of this was to make a deal about representation. Nobody was thinking about what is a direct tax. Someone late in the convention, Governor Morgan, says, by the way, we have this phrase in here, direct taxes, what does it mean? And Madison, James Madison's notes, which are our record of this debate, our best record, says in response to Governor Morris, he says, no one answered. They had no idea what this meant. They didn't care what this meant. What they cared about was getting a representation plan that would enable them to write a U.S. Constitution.
Defenders of slavery were very clever in some of their rhetorical tactics, framing defenses of slavery as anti-elitist, and also they kept claiming how unproductive slavery was, and that we're supposed to pity them. They're supposed to be indulged because this institution was so unprofitable and burdensome, yet it was also supposed to be protected. What about this Southern rhetoric? It was remarkably contradictory, but it seemed to have been at least somewhat successful.
It wasn't successful because it was rhetoric. It was successful in a power politics kind of way. My favorite person in this part of the story is Patrick Henry, right? He's famous for something he said in 1776 or 5, the give me liberty or give me death line. But Henry was a very important politician in Virginia who was opposed to the Constitution. And most historians explaining this say he was afraid, and this is so great from a 21st century perspective, he's afraid the presidency would become too powerful. The president would be a king. But if you look at most of what he said, it was that the North would interfere with slavery. But his argument was even better than that. His argument was, look, everybody knows that slavery is evil. We all know that. But we Southerners, Southern whites, right, we're stuck with it. It's our society. We can't just free the slaves. In fact, we shouldn't. He says we should be able to enjoy them as the inheritance of our ancestors. But because slavery was so obviously evil, Northerners, and slavery was in the process of being abolished slowly, more slowly in some northern states than in others, but it was on the way out in the North. And he says, therefore, these northern whites won't be able to sympathize with our problem of enslaving people. He says the pity of humanity will overcome any kind of hard-headed politics, and they're going to move toward abolition. It's just inevitable, and how do we know that? Because we, Virginia slaveholders, understand just how evil slavery is.
Jefferson was not above making similar arguments, was he?
Now, Jefferson was not part of the framing of the Constitution. He was in France. The genius who protected slavery was James Madison. Just brilliant in manipulating factions in debates to get people to go where he wants them to go. Jefferson, in Notes on the State of Virginia, his only book, he says, look, we've got to abolish slavery. It's obviously evil. It debases white society. But we can only do it, he says, by sending all of the African Americans to Africa and, he says, importing an equal number of European laborers. And why do you need to do this? Because, he says, if you have white people and black people together, inevitably you're going to have racial intermarriage. You're going to have racial mixing. And what's wrong with racial mixing? Jefferson has an answer to that question. He actually says it will make the white race less beautiful.
It didn't stop him.
No, it didn't.
Skipping over some details, The tariff then became the magic bullet to avoid all these difficulties over slavery. Then the tariff was the way out, right? How did the tariff solve this problem?
So import taxes were the solution completely because you collect them at the ports from merchants, and then the merchants shift them into prices as they sell their goods domestically. And what this means is nobody decides in advance which groups are going to pay how much. You don't have to apportion this tax to identifiable groups. If you buy the things that are taxed in a tariff, you will pay tariff on them. And at first, there were not that many of these goods. They were kind of identifiable. So you had arguments in Virginia, like Madison was fond of pointing out, that if you just didn't buy silver shoe buckles, it'll be good for us. He didn't like conspicuous consumption. So look, you could avoid the tax if you don't have silver shoe buckles. But the tariff doesn't remain that for long, because the political logic of the tariff, while you didn't have to apportion it to identifiable groups, the political logic of the tariff is that it was framed by Congress until 1934. And because congressmen made the tariff, every congressman would try to get a little thing in there to protect the products of his own constituents. So tariffs grew. They got longer and longer and more protective and more protective, in part because in the North you got the rise of a protectionist pro-industry ideology, but also because of this kind of inevitable inflation. Here's the way to think about it. Why is our income tax code complicated? It's complicated, among other things, because it's written by Congress. And that means that each member of Congress sticks pieces into that tax code to benefit their own constituents. And that's exactly what happened with the tariff. It balloons, it gets highly protective through the logic of the situation, in addition to the fact that there was a protectionist movement in the North. Southerners are furious at this. This is what causes in the early 1830s, the nullification crisis, which is when South Carolina threatens to secede from the Union because they hate the tariff. And they think it's just grossly unfair that a majority in Congress gets to decide how to tax them.
What was it about South Carolina? They're repeatedly troublesome. Is it because they have a very large population of slaves, or is something else in the South Carolinian political culture?
40% of Virginians were enslaved at the time of the Revolution. 60% of South Carolinians were enslaved. 60%. So whites are a minority, and in some counties, in fact, the rich counties, the richer the counties, the larger proportion of the population was enslaved, because, of course, the slaves aren't in the denominator, right? When you say a place is rich, you only count the people who are allowed to own wealth. So you have desperate, horrible living conditions for a vast majority, but the minority is super rich. So South Carolina is very much shaped by the fact that there was a black majority.
I'm speaking with the historian Robin Einhorn.
Okay, so back to the tariff. Southerners get increasingly irritated with this thing that they initially wanted because they perceive it as protecting northern industry at their expense.
Right, which it did.
Yes, no, true. And although at the latter part of the 19th century, there was some social spending on pensions and such that somewhat neutralized the regressive nature of a consumption tax, which is what a tariff is, it was burdensome to ordinary people and a gift to northern industrialists. How did the South then begin to express its discontent with the tariff politically?
Right. So the nullification crisis in the 1830s is the first big one. Oh, and they win. Tariff goes down, down, down in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. It's very low until the late 1850s, when the Southerners are getting ready to leave and begin essentially the Civil War. The minute they leave in early 1861, they're not there anymore, and the Republicans, an overwhelmingly, well, no, a completely Northern party, rams through a very high tariff because the Southerners are no longer there to stop them. And tariffs remain high after the Civil War, when other taxes that were enacted to help finance the Civil War, like including an income tax, were all abolished. The tariff raised all of federal revenue in the decades before the Civil War. And after the Civil War, it raised about half federal revenue. The other half came from very regressive excises on liquor and tobacco, which also had their Southern opponents, right? Southern tobaccos being taxed. You have the famous wars between the revenuers and the mountain distillers in the rural South. But what you have is a system that not only is highly regressive, but it also was especially sectional. It took from the South and gave to the North. So Southerners hated this, but they couldn't really do anything about it in the late 19th century. The Republican Party is very strong, and they keep the tariffs very, very high. The only way they decide to get that tariff down is in another form of federal taxation. And that's how you get the bizarre spectacle of the federal income tax being a Southern project in the late 19th century. It was the way to get the tariff down. And more importantly, the early income taxes were levied only on the very rich. Think of something like what Elizabeth Warren is talking about with her 2 cents tax on multimillionaires. That's what this tax was supposed to be. And in fact, New York in 1916 is the first year we have geographical data on this. New York paid 45% of the personal income tax. That's what the income tax was for. It was to redress the sectional balance and to provide an alternative revenue source to the tariff. And the tariff now stays high through the 19-teens and 20s. Income tax is first inaugurated with the Constitutional Amendment in 1913. That's the first year of federal income tax. But what happens when the Democrats, which is the Southern Party throughout the 19th and early 20th century, when the Democrats finally come to power in a landslide, that would be 1932, right, Roosevelt, they end that 19th century tariff by moving, and this is really kind of funny considering where we are right now, by moving tariff making out of Congress to the executive branch, to the State Department, making tariff policy what we today might call, or do call, international economic policy, as opposed to a mainstay of federal revenue set by Congress. And as a result of this, 1934, a law with the fetching name, the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act, moved tariff making out of Congress. The rates plummeted, the revenue plummeted, and they have never approached the height that they were. Of course, right now, we're looking at the executive branch's ability to make tariffs independently of Congress as suddenly a problem again. But it's been a while.
How did this switch happen, given that Roosevelt himself was a New Yorker?
Southerners were very, very important as a Democratic Party constituency and had been for decades, right? Because none of them were Republicans. That was the party of Lincoln, North in the Civil War. So basically, there's two Democratic parties. There's a party in the North, which is actually kind of complicated. In some places, it's about white supremacy. In other places, you start to get real kind of progressive policymaking, and New York would be one of those places. But in the South, it's the party of white supremacy, pure and simple, and the interests of Southern an overwhelmingly agricultural South that got hurt by tariffs. And that was very poor. So when sometimes we talk about how the South really won the Civil War because they were able to implement the regime of white supremacy, and yes, that happened. Reconstruction failed. But as a result of losing the Civil War, they did really impoverish the South for generations. As a result of maintaining white supremacy. So the South was poor, and an income tax levied on the rich would be great for them because they wouldn't pay it.
You then identify a possible source of the tax rebellions of recent decades in the fact that that disparity, that regional disparity, narrowed, and the Southerners, as the income tax began touching a larger and larger portion of the population, that regional disparity narrowed, and the South caught up to the North in the share of taxes that it was paying, right? And that that helped inspire some tax rebellions in Dixie?
When I collected all of this data, what the remarkable thing to discover was that the South, which had been way behind both the West and the Midwest, all three other regions and the Northeast, had been way behind. Then when do they start paying as much as everyone else? When do they catch up? 1980. Well, what else happens in 1980, right? That's the election of Reagan, of course. That's the beginning of the kind of modern, I don't know if we call it neoliberal, but the destruction of the New Deal state. And it's with heavily Southern votes. The Southern whites become Republicans. And part of it was Reagan's racial appeal, the Philadelphia-Mississippi kickoff, touting states' rights. We know that story. But the other thing that happens is that Southerners are finally paying income tax as much as everyone else. So Southern Democrats, and that's the other thing about Southern power, Congress operated by a seniority system. And what that meant was whenever Democrats won elections, Southerners chaired the major committees. And Southerners always chaired the financial committees of the House and the Senate, the tax writing committees, most famously Wilbur Mills of Arkansas for decades. But they were always, since the 1930s, always Southerners. And they protected the income tax. Wilbur Mills did it by amassing kind of technocratic understanding of how to protect this tax that benefited his constituents. But then what happens in 1980 is that Southerners are now paying as much as everyone else, and now the income tax isn't such a great deal for them anymore. And this happens at the same time that you get the racial politics that also moved Southerners into the Republican Party starting in the late 70s.
And, of course, they weakened the seniority system in Congress, too.
They did, yes, party reform.
No more Wilbur Mills anymore.
No.
Well, finally, what about the sudden salience of the tariff under Trump? It's something that nobody had thought about, except maybe in history class, for decades. Here we have Trump bringing back the tariff among one of many of his backward-looking policies. What do you make of that? How could we think about this return to salience of the tariff, which is something we thought had died?
It's a tariff, but it is a foreign economic policy. It's nowhere near the levels of the real tariff regime of the 19th and early 20th century. We're still talking about very small, in historical perspective, small amounts of money and rates of tax. What he is doing is reviving that old protectionist rhetoric that I think most Americans thought was kind of gone after the debacle of Smoot-Hawley, the last high tariff from 1930. We've had pockets, for example, Sherrod Brown of Ohio wrote a really nice little book about why tariffs would be very good for reviving American industry. This was in, I think he wrote it in the 90s. I'm not certain about when. But a very nice book, unapologetically pro-protectionist from the left, right? Sherrod Brown. I really hesitate to ascribe non-personal logics to anything Trump does. So I don't know.
Well, he thinks the Chinese are paying the tariffs, too, which is
so stupid.
A non-standard position.
Non-standard. Otherwise known as completely wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You listened to my interview with John Clegg last week and said you wanted to complicate the slavery argument with your reading of the income tax.
What I meant by that is, coming out of my book American Taxation, American Slavery, which ends at the Civil War, coming out of that book, I saw things that looked very much like they would have shaped American policy for the long haul. And I think Clegg actually pointed to those. The reverence for property rights, the weak federal state, the weak, especially for issues of redistribution, the fear of elites that they were sitting on top of a volcano, which you still see in American politics. They really think they're an endangered species. It's incredible. And you could compare that to the rhetoric of elites who really were sitting on top of a volcano, the owners of enslaved African Americans. So that's where I thought I was. But then when I started doing research on the income tax and the tariff and really the origin of the income tax, and started to notice Southern support for the income tax, and in fact how crucial Southern support was, that made that direct line from 1865 to now, it clearly didn't work. So as I did more research on that, I kind of realize that the way to think about this is not that people have ideological consistency over centuries, but that people change their ideologies as their interests change. And when Southerners were clear beneficiaries of an income tax that taxed Northerners, but not them, they were perfectly happy to have a constitutional amendment increasing the power of the federal government dramatically. Alabama was the first state to ratify the income tax amendment. 7 of the first 10 had been slave states during the Civil War because they saw this new tax, this massive, really, expansion of federal power as something that was in their interests. Once it was no longer in their interests, they stopped talking that way.
Yeah, once they started paying the tax in size, then their ardor for it faded.
Exactly, yes.
That was Robin Einhorn, Professor Emerita of History at Berkeley, and author of American Taxation, American Slavery, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2006. You can find a short essay of hers, Tax Aversion and the Legacy of Slavery, on her Berkeley webpage. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some more Scarlatti played by Scott Ross, this the Sonata No. 355 in the Ralph Kirkpatrick catalog. Till next week, bye.